From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
Welcome to the June 2021 episode of the Bletchley Park podcast. Fall Gelb, Part 1. In May 1940, the much-anticipated German attack on France brings the phony war to an end. The French have the largest land army in the world, the Maginot Line giving them hundreds of miles of defences, and they know the route the Germans will take. But in the space of only a few weeks, the entire strategic course of World War II is turned on its head. The Germans have gambled on a new invasion plan, Fall Gelb, or Case Yellow, to set them on a risky route through the Ardennes and a dash to the coast. With so many dramatic events happening in such a short period of time, we'll be telling the story of Fall Gelb over two It Happened Here episodes. In this first part, Dr. Thomas Cheetham takes us through the planning and first phases of the operation and the German and Allied intelligence activity that surrounded it. Special thanks go to Sarah Langston and Dr. Ben Thompson for voicing our archival documents.
This is Bletchley Park. It happened here.
It's been a while since our last It Happened Here episodes. Just to recap, we had covered Alan Turing's first wartime break into Enigma in January 1940, and also an episode, Invasion Norway, where we looked at the invasion of Denmark and Norway. But Tom, can you kind of remind us a little bit, give us a picture of the general situation of the war as we come up to May 1940?
Sure. So the first act of war was the German invasion of Poland, and that wrapped up in October with the Poles obviously falling to Germany and the USSR. Since then, the British and the French have been building up their forces on the Western Front on their border with Germany. And we have a period now which has become known as the phony war, Sitzkrieg if you're German and Drôle de Guerre for the French, where not a lot happens. In the latter part of 1939 and the start of 1940, both sides are just building up their forces and waiting to see what happens. In April, as you say, the Germans attack Norway. This is really the onset of the hot war between Germany, France and Britain. It comes unexpectedly. By the end of April, the British and French have withdrawn from most of Norway. Fighting will go on into June, overlapping what we might call the main battle, which is in France. And that's where all eyes are turning at the stage in May, because there an attack by the Germans very much is expected. Allied planning is much better developed. They are expecting the Germans to make a move. And as we will see, there are certain problems with that planning. The Allied strategy at this stage of the war is defensive. And it's based on the experience of the First World War. The last time around, the French firstly found themselves caught in very, very costly encounter battles on the borders as they tried to attack into Germany the same time as the Germans tried to invade France via Belgium. And these were very, very costly. And in the process, the French lost a lot of men, but also they ended up losing a lot of the border country, which contained important industry and agricultural areas. And that took a long time for the French to come back from. So in 1940, this priority is not to lose territory, not to lose too many men, and to build up French forces so that they can launch an offensive in a place and at a time of their choosing. And the linchpin really to the strategy is the Maginot Line, which is a line of fortifications built up on the Franco-German border, which, you know, comprises some of the most modern fortifications in the world at that time.
So you say the Franco-German border, what about Belgium?
Right, so Belgium is crucial here. The first time around, in 1914, the Germans had advanced through Belgium according to their Schlieffen plan and attempted to outflank where they hoped the main French forces were and make their way to Paris. And it didn't work out on that occasion. But this is the strategy which the French are still expecting the Germans to carry out. Belgium has always been a focus of conflict in Europe. It's where the easy routes for attacking armies are. And it gives the French the opportunity to fight the crucial battle away from French territory, away from all their important war industry and agriculture. So that's what they're expecting the Germans to do. And the French plan, when the Germans attack through Belgium, is to advance into Belgium and set up a defensive line on the River Dyle. So it's called the Dyle Plan. And there are various variations that involve advancing further into the Netherlands, or not advancing so far and defending closer to the French border. But the idea is to fight the battle in Belgium, not in France. The difficulty here is that Belgium has declared its neutrality in the late 30s, and it wants to stay out of the conflict if at all possible. And the Belgian worry is that if they align themselves to the French, they are just going to provoke a German invasion. And if the Germans aren't going to invade, they don't want to give them a good reason to. So the French are relying on having enough warning of a German attack to either force the Belgians to come to their side and join the war and let French troops cross the border, or that the Belgian army is going to hold off the German army long enough for the French troops to take up position in their defensive line and get dug in, and then they will be in a position to fight the battle that they want to fight. As we will see, it doesn't quite turn out that way. If you think about the strategic geography of the front here, the other area we should be aware of is the Ardennes, which is this forested, hilly area in southern Belgium. It's not covered by the Maginot Line, firstly because it's on the border with Belgium, secondly because it's not believed to be prime attacking territory. Modern attacking forces depend on armour and they depend on trucks. And these require good roads, they require bridges if they need to cross rivers, they require large numbers of logistics to carry fuel and ammunition. All of this is difficult to do in terrain like the Ardennes. And the French commander-in-chief, Maurice Gamelin, especially, has a conception that the Ardennes cannot be used by the Germans. That if they try and go through the Ardennes, they're going to run into problems with the quality of the roads, and the number of the roads aren't sufficient to support a large attacking force. And it's going to be easy for defenders to slow them down. And then by the time they reach the French border, they actually hit another geographic barrier, which is the River Meuse, and have to cross that. And by the time the Germans do that, the French will have been able to bring up enough reinforcements to stop them dead. So he doesn't think that will be possible. The assumption is that the Germans are going to go round through the main part of northern Belgium like they did in the First World War.
The winter of 1939 and 40 was described by amateur statesmen and strategists as the period of the phony war. France was waiting behind its Maginot Line, that vast underground fortress deemed impregnable by its military experts. Allied strategy relied upon starving the Reich into submission. Hitler's armies would collapse for lack of fuel and food and raw materials.
You've told us about the French strategy. What was the German strategy?
So the German strategy initially is very much like the French anticipate. Their plan is called Faulgelb. It means cage yellow. It's their plan for invading France and the Low Countries. And it's the brainchild of Franz Halder, who's chief of staff of the German Army High Command. Initially, it's a somewhat limited plan strategically. They aim to take over the Low Countries and they aim to deal damage to France, but not necessarily knock France out of the war in one go. The Germans, when they invade Poland, do not expect war to break out. So that means their planning for a war against France and Britain is pretty basic. Then war does break out and Hitler decides that France must be attacked, and therefore the planning is quite rushed. And this means that Halder initially takes the Schlieffen plan out of the cupboard and he rehashes it for 1940. So Faulgelb, in the initial conception, is an advance through central Belgium. But this doesn't happen. Hitler orders the plan to be implemented several times from November through to January 1940, but it's cancelled every time because the German army isn't in a good enough position, the weather is bad, for whatever reason. One occasion where the plan is cancelled in January 1940 is because of what's become known as the Mechelen incident. So there was a German pilot called Erich Honemans who was taking flight over Western Germany, lost his way, ended up over Belgium, attempting to find the Rhine, but heading into neutral territory and eventually crash lands. The problem here for the Germans was that he had a passenger, Helmut Rheinberger, who was an Air Force officer who was on the way to a staff meeting. And in his briefcase, unknown to the pilot, he was carrying a copy of Faulgelb. So this pair crash land in a field which they think is in Germany, but on discovering from a farmhand that they're in Belgium, Rheinberger panics. He screams that he's got plans that he needs to destroy. He tries to burn the documents by the aircraft with a lighter, but the lighter malfunctions. Then the Belgian farmhand gives him a match, which he uses to try and burn the documents. But before he's finished, two Belgian border guards arrive. They see the smoke. And they managed to stamp out the fire, so they saved the documents.
Slightly farcical, isn't it?
It is a bit. And the two Germans are taken for interrogation in a guardhouse, and there's a stove in the guardhouse. And they're left in this room with a stove, and the documents are put on the table. And then the Belgian officer who's doing the interrogation turns his back, and Reinberger takes the opportunity to stuff the documents in the stove. But as he lifts the lid of the stove, it burns his hand. He screams. The Belgian officer realizes what's going on and manages to snatch the documents out of the fire. So they're saved again. And at this point, Reinberger then tries to grab the officer's revolver to commit suicide because he thinks his career is over and he's not possibly coming back from this because he's just given away the entire plan for the German attack on France and the Low Countries. The Germans quickly realize the documents have gone missing. Reinberger doesn't turn up, but they hope they've been destroyed. The initial response from the German high command is actually to bring the attack forward. It was scheduled for 17th of January, but as the crisis unfolds, they actually decide to cancel the plan and not go ahead with it for reasons including the weather. When the French find out the documents have been captured, and the Belgians let the French know, and they also let the Germans know eventually, the French actually suspect these are a plant.
Because it's so unlikely, this series of events.
It just seems so serendipitous an event. So there is a question about whether the French actually believe these plans are genuine. They try and exploit the situation to get the Belgians to realise the Germans are planning to attack them and to let French troops into the country. There is some movement in that direction, but after no attack takes place, the Belgians refuse to let the French in. They reaffirm their neutrality. So not a lot changes strategically. And actually, the plans as captured don't give away that much, because they confirm the Germans are going to do what the French already expect them to do. They're going to do the traditional plan of approach through Belgium. The main result seems to be that it gives the Germans an opportunity to reassess their plan of attack. And while they're waiting, while they're reassessing, new ideas come to the fore. A new plan emerges from the Germans, which is known as the Manstein plan, named after the originator, Erich von Manstein, who's a chief of staff of one of the German army groups at that stage in the war. And he criticises Halder's plan because it's too predictable. The Germans are going to do exactly what the French and exactly what everyone else expect them to do, and it's not going to lead to a decisive result. So it doesn't fulfil the criteria which the Germans always emphasise, which is that a plan of attack is going to aim to destroy the enemy armed forces, bring the war to a quick conclusion. That's the sort of German way of war. It has been ever since the Prussians of Frederick the Great, all the way through the 19th century with the Franco-Prussian War and all of this.
So how is Manstein's plan different?
Manstein decides that Germans should throw their armour through the Ardennes exactly where the French aren't expecting them. They will make a feint against central Belgium and they will put their main thrust and most of their armour through the Ardennes, get behind the French before they know what's happening and drive for the sea. And because the French have put most of their quality troops in the north and they will advance into Belgium believing that's where the main German attack has taken place, the German thrust to the sea will cut them off from their supplies, force them to surrender quickly, destroy those forces, and then the French military will be decisively weakened and France will fall.
This seems quite a radical change to the status quo, I suppose. How was this plan received?
Not that well. Manstein was a rival of Halder, so when he presents his plans, they actually never get anywhere near Hitler and never get anywhere near being accepted. And he's actually sidelined. He's given command of an obscure corps in eastern Germany and doesn't take much part in the eventual battle on the Western Front at all. But eventually, allies of Manstein are able to get word of his ideas to Hitler. And Hitler himself, he's always looking for what seems modern and unexpected in his strategies. He was thinking along similar lines about Halder's plan, and he disliked the fact that it wasn't decisive enough. And eventually, Manstein does get an audience with Hitler on 17th of February, and his ideas are adopted. But the key thing here is that Halder is still in charge of the planning. So he takes Manstein's plan. Actually, I think in the end, comes to see the benefits in it, but he does dial it back. He does devote less armour, and he, in a way, waters down that armoured offensive by adding infantry. And he also decides that once the armour is across the Meuse, then they should stop, wait for the Germans to build up their forces before pressing onwards. So they adopt the plan, but not wholeheartedly, not exactly as Manstein intended it.
Halder adopts this plan. Is Manstein given a role in this? Is he put in charge of it?
Manstein's not put in charge of it. He has a role later in the Battle of France, but it's quite a minor one. Mostly his contribution is to suggest the idea and then other generals are the ones who actually carry it out. Even the plan as dialed back by Halder to make it more acceptable to the rest of the generals, it's still considered incredibly risky. And most of the German generals think it's mad to throw their best armoured forces through tough terrain and then over a river into the jaws of the enemy with sort of limited logistical options and not expect them just to be destroyed. It's like throwing away the cream of the German armoured divisions. It seems like a mad idea. And this is especially so because the balance of forces is so much against Germany. France is the foremost military power in the world. It has the largest army. It has the most technically advanced army. In the end, as it turns out, both sides are broadly similar in personnel. But in tanks, the Germans are actually decisively outnumbered. They have about 2,500 tanks. The French have 4,000. And the German tanks also are smaller than French models, less well armoured, but they do tend to be faster and more reliable. So they've got that going for them. Most of the German army is not these fantastic panzer spearheads, and it's not motorised infantry. It's foot infantry. They're still dependent on horse-drawn transport. So only about 10% of the German army is actually motorised at this stage compared to the entire British army and a larger proportion of the French army. And a lot of the German army is also conscripts with limited training who've only been in the army since the previous year. So it does seem to the German generals whether they can achieve a decisive superiority over the French is very, very questionable.
You mentioned about the French having this technological advantage over the Germans in terms of the army. What about the Air Force? Which side had superiority there?
This is the one area where the Germans can feel a bit safer. The French do have slightly more aircraft, but not so many committed to the actual battle, as it turns out. The Germans, they're at the cutting edge in how you use aircraft and especially how you use it to support your ground operations. They have good radio communications. They've got a doctrine about close air support for their armoured troops. And they have people on the ground whose job it is to make sure the air forces and the armour coordinate effectively. Who are these FLEVOs who actually other people Bletchley are listening in on quite a lot of the time. The French system is a lot more basic and in many ways more old-fashioned. This goes for their air support, but also across their army. Most communications by telephone. A lot of the tanks don't have radios. And the problem is that the French armour tends to be distributed. It tends to be spread around as infantry support rather than concentrated in certain divisions intended for decisive sort of breakthroughs. And the French are planning generally to fight a much more methodical war on the model of what had worked in 1918 rather than what will turn out is the predominant way of war in the 1940s. So it's not fair to say the Germans had all the advantages. They were not the superior soldiers and they were not better prepared than the French. But the French had prepared for the last war. The Germans had prepared to do something quite new and quite special.
Unusual precautions are being taken in the Netherlands tonight. All canal locks in the vicinity of Amsterdam have been closed. The Dutch radio has been shut down by government order. Outgoing telephone and teletype communications have been shut off. And any large gatherings of civilians have been prohibited in the frontier districts by the military authorities. A day or two ago, it was rumored that this would be the critical day in this latest invasion crisis, and apparently the Dutch government is taking no chances. But there is as yet no confirmation of the reports of German troop movements that have been current for the last 2 days, and stories that the German army has taken over the railroads for the weekend have been denied in Berlin, though it's admitted that there has been some limitation on ticket sales.
You've mentioned the Germans, you've mentioned the French. Of course, we haven't mentioned the British yet. Can you give us some information about them?
This is really France's battle. The French have the large army. The BEF, the British Expeditionary Force in France, contributes 13 divisions. France has 104 divisions on the front. So even, you know, as highly trained and as well equipped as the British are, and they are not in a bad situation, they could use more tanks. They don't have brilliant coordination with their air forces either. But even if they perform really well, they can't make an enormous change to the big picture because this is really about what the French army is going to do and how the French army is going to perform. The British, they're stationed at the north end of the front, nearer the sea, and they can do what they can to try and support the French army, but really it comes down to whether the French or the Germans come out on top.
I'm interested in finding a bit more about what was happening at Bletchley at this time. Can you give us a bit of background?
Yeah, so Bletchley's building up, but it's still early days. It's still relatively small scale. Enigma's been broken since January, and that's a great breakthrough, but it's still at a small scale. They're still not reading that many communications. Partly that's because they're still learning their trade. Partly it's because not that much is going out on the airwaves yet because the war isn't hot. So we have Hut 6, which is doing the decryption of Enigma, and then we also have Hut 3, which is set up by Frederick Winterbottom of MI6. To actually translate the decrypts. and make some useful intelligence from them. And these are all passed on to MI6 for dissemination.
Can I just ask, you say of Enigma, what kind of communications are we talking about here? Army, Air Force, Navy, all of the above?
Yeah, we're talking about Army, Air Force, Enigma, the Enigma I, the Naval Enigma will take some more time to break. That's what Turing is working on at this very moment, and what his bomb machine will contribute to, most importantly. But that's all to come later on. The focus here is on the Army Air Enigma. So they're giving these decrypts to MI6, they're giving them to the ministries in London, and there is a basic network for disseminating them to the headquarters of the British Army and the French Army in France. But it's not as extensive and it's not as responsive as the SCUSOU system that will be set up later in the war. What we see at Bletchley Park at this time are debates about how they should handle Enigma and what GCNCS's actual role is when it's handling it. And problems are really caused by the fact Huts 3 and 6 sit outside the nice service-based arrangement, which was the organisation of GCNCS before the war. But Enigma has to remain segregated from the pre-existing system because of the security angle. I found an interesting memo in the archives from 15th of May, so just after the battle starts, in which Malcolm Saunders, who's head of Hut 3, proposes setting up a central intelligence room for all the fighting services through which all information should pass out to the appropriate ministries in London. And this is a controversial idea, even though he's basically envisioning what Hut 3 will become later in the war. It's too much at this stage of the war. It seems to exceed GCNCS's remit, which is to break codes, but not to actually do intelligence. The intelligence is meant to be done by the customers. And even Hut 3, you know, exists to translate Enigma, not to come up with the finished intelligence product. But what's interesting is we also have the responses of several key figures to this idea that Saunders comes up with. We have Gordon Welshman talking about action intelligence as opposed to deferred intelligence. Intelligence which needs to be sent out and acted on this minute compared to building up knowledge over time. That's a really important concept which will govern how a lot of this works later on. Frank Birch of Naval Section, he wants a service split and he wants every service to have its own crypto and traffic analysis and intelligence sections at GCNCS. But he acknowledges this would risk impinging on what they're doing in the ministries. So what he is most concerned about is cooperation on in terms of things like cribs and spotting opportunities at weaknesses in the enemy communications, which can be exploited. And he actually thinks GCNCS are doing an okay job at that because they are a group of friends who talk to each other. So that functions. And there's concern from others about if you put a central intelligence section together, will it cause a bottleneck for intelligence going out to the customers? And will it stop cryptographic opportunities being spotted?
It feels like there's quite a lot of internal disagreement over what GCNCS's role was and what their work achieved and who they were.
Yeah, so there's a lot of theoretical, you might call, disagreement over exactly what they're doing and why. And there are people who want to pull it in all sorts of different directions. And this means that even though they're working quite efficiently, none of this is set in stone, and it will take some time before the shape of the organisation really settles down and it can start growing into something really efficient.
In our previous episode, Invasion Norway, we found out that Naval Section found it quite difficult to get the Admiralty to pay attention to the intelligence that they were producing. Was this the same with the other sections as well?
Yeah, so during the Battle of Norway, one of the results for that is that the Admiralty gets a much better appreciation of what GCNCS can do for them because of Harry Hinsley's warnings about the naval situation, which were initially ignored, and then belatedly they realised he does know what he's talking about.
Well, they were, of course, very standoffish to begin with. It took quite a long time, and one or two, well, perhaps I could say disasters, before you got their respect. They had no more idea of the need for meticulousness in studying this kind of thing than fly. So they couldn't see what we were beginning to be able to see from it. And first we had commotion before the Germans went to Norway, on which I was able to say, look, there is commotion. I don't know what it is, but they didn't take any notice. They didn't take any notice of what other information either before Norway. But then, more seriously, I did give them warning from this external study that big ships were leaving the Baltic, or were preparing to. And I pressed them a bit, and they wouldn't send a signal out. And then, of course, the Scharnhorst and the Gneisenau, two battle cruisers sank one of our aircraft carriers, the Glorious, without any warning at all. But they quickly turned their cheek after that.
There is a similar attitude in the War Office and the Air Ministry to what GCNCS is doing. They are seen as breaking codes and providing a raw product, which the intelligence specialists at the ministries are going to actually analyse. And the problem is sort of worsened by the fact that the Enigma information is coming out disguised as agents' reports, as boniface, as they call it at this stage. The Air Ministry in particular is very, very zealous about not letting its component of GCNCS do anything that can be construed as intelligence. And this will go on really until 1943, 1944. This is still a problem for Air Section. The War Office is not quite as bad, but there is still a problem getting the right people to pay attention to this material as it arrives at the War Office. It just doesn't stand out from the crowd, and until the people who need to be reading it appreciate what it is, appreciate how reliable it is, and appreciate the value in it, and until GCNCS is allowed to help them do that by doing its own level of analysis, again, that's another thing holding the system back at this stage. The machine is there, but it's not working as smoothly as it should be, and as it will later on.
Was Bletchley Park still working directly with the French and the Polish codebreakers, like we mentioned in our previous episode?
Yeah, so that's the other part of the system, is what the French and the Polish are doing. And of course, Turing has visited Paris around the time of the first wartime Enigma breaks in January 1940. So the first breaks take place in Paris, but that's only possible because of the work the British have done constructing these net sheets, which the Polish codebreakers are able to use. So cooperation is essential, and it keeps on being very, very important for both sides.
Net sheets, are they the same thing or similar to Zagalski sheets?
Yeah, they are. They're exactly the same thing. Most people at Bletchley Park don't know who Zagalski is, so they call them net sheets. But yeah, they are the same thing, as the Poles have been using to break Enigma up to late 1938 when they had their additional rotors.
And who was Zagalski?
Zagalski is one of the Polish codebreakers, along with Marian Rzewski and Jerzy Rosicki, who have been working on Enigma all the way through the 1930s.
What was GCNCS's relationship like with the French and the Poles?
So they're talking back and forth. They're exchanging information, intelligence, they're exchanging ideas. It's not complete cooperation, because there's clearly a lot which isn't being shared. The British are reading certain Enigma keys, the French and the Polish are reading other ones. They're reading different keys on different days, and that seems like it's a fairly haphazard system, and maybe they're not coordinating to achieve full coverage. There's a limited amount of information on that, but you get the impression that they are somewhat working in a bubble at the same time. Personnel are sent back and forth, but the French refused to allow the Polish to come over to Britain, even though Commander Denniston really would have liked them to have done so.
Can I just ask you a question about personnel? We've mentioned Turing from the British, and you've mentioned Zagalski, Rzewski and Rzycki from the Polish side. When we talk about the French, who are we talking about here?
The French codebreaking organisation is a deuxième bureau, and it's under Gustave Bertrand. And he has, obviously, French officers working on various things. He has a few Spanish Republicans working on Spanish ciphers, and he has the Poles who are working on Enigma. And they are doing most of the Enigma work, actually. And Bertrand is actually one of the officers who visits Bletchley shortly after the outbreak of war. He's looked after by Dilly Knox, who it seems finds the experience quite strange, actually. But the other group of Frenchmen who come over to Bletchley are actually nothing to do with Bertrand at all, because they're naval codebreakers from the French Navy's headquarters in Epernon. Eight of these naval officers, Capitaine Hutter, Lieutenants Graverand, Delapierre, Schaefer, Kiefer, Royer, Vey, and Miron Bell. And they come over to work at Bletchley, and they're billeted in Stony Stratford in the two inns there called the Cock and the Bull, which is meant to be where we get our idea of a cock and bull story. It's a story which you always heard in the other pub. And so GCNCS are talking to French codebreakers at the Army High Command with Bertrand, but they're also talking to the French Navy. We have a very nice vignette of one of these French officers, Lieutenant Schaefer. He was an archaeologist actually by trade. And he worked with a lady in naval section called Patricia Sandback, and she describes him.
He was a delightful man, tall and distinguished, very correct, immaculate in his uniform. He astounded me one day when, in his excitement on solving a difficult problem, he bounded across the room, caught me in his arms and kissed me. I backed away into a very hot tortoise stove, which burnt and scorched my dress above the back of my knees. During the lunch hour, he borrowed a bicycle to get to my billet, where he asked Mrs. Tarbrush for my coat, as I felt cold.
From a privately published memoir by Patricia Sandbach.
There's also a contribution from the French Air Force, and there's three Air Force officers come over called Baudouin, Allier and Mélin. They come over in May, and actually Baudouin is an important figure, and he's actually head of cryptography at the headquarters of the French Air Force. So the French are not sending over their duffers. They are sending over their star players. You get the feeling that they are really, both sides really, are committed to this partnership. And had things continued in this vein for longer, then you would have had a very close partnership built up there. And the sort of inefficiencies would have been ironed out and things would have been rationalised. And I think the two nations would have worked very effectively together. And that wasn't to be. But I feel like if France hadn't fallen, you would see a sort of level of cooperation similar to what comes later on with the Americans. There's actually liaison with another country as well, which is Finland. It's a democracy. It's in conflict in late 1939, early 1940 with the USSR in what's called the Winter War. In March 1940, John Tiltman, who is GCNCS's chief expert on Russian cryptanalysis, goes over to Helsinki to talk to the Finns. Obviously, this partnership is aligned towards the USSR because that is still a potential aggressor and potential enemy for Britain at this stage. And obviously, this liaison doesn't go too far. Once the Germans attack the USSR in 1941, the Finns will side with them. But it's clear that the British are putting out feelers wherever they can, trying to build up relationships all around the world, really, at this stage, wherever it can possibly be advantageous.
What is the outcome of this? What do they know about what the Germans are planning?
They know quite a lot about what the German armed forces looks like, and they're able to put up quite a good picture based on what they're reading. What they don't know is what the Germans are intending to do. Nobody does, actually. Allied intelligence in general has a good idea of where the Germans are and what their capabilities are, but they don't see the German plan coming. They don't see the attack coming, as it turns out. The problem is a lot of the German armour is actually positioned so that it can attack either through central Belgium, where the Allies are expecting, or through the Ardennes, where they're not expecting. And so a lot of this is interpreted according to the Allied preconceptions, of course. There is no clear intelligence that the Germans have changed their plan to that Manstein plan, which the Allies can seize on and work out what's going on. There are many warnings that the attack is about to happen, and most of these come to nothing. A lot of them come from agents, they come from sources which aren't considered very reliable. Actually, one person who gives warning that foul gel was about to be unleashed is Hans-Thilo Schmidt, who is the German spy for the French, who'd actually provided the information about the Enigma, which allowed the Polish to start breaking it back in the early 30s. And he's one of many agents who tries to give warning of what they expect the Germans to do. But there's no way to determine which of these predictions are accurate, which are completely spurious. A lot of them do turn out to be spurious. The upshot of this really is that there is no solid forewarning of the time of the attack or the form it will take. Harry Hinsley in the official history says it's impossible to decide whether this outcome resulted from a continuing lack of firm intelligence or from disregard by either the intelligence or the operational authorities of last-minute evidence. But basically, Allied intelligence isn't able to come up to a sensible conclusion about what the Germans are going to do and give proper warning. And maybe it's doubtful whether they could, even if they had, you know, if they had the sort of smoking gun of exactly what the Germans were going to do. Whether this would change the picture for the Allied leadership is pretty doubtful. They were expecting the Germans to attack, and they really did believe that they knew how they were going to do it. And so it would take very, very strong intelligence to change their opinions about that.
So could you say that GCNCS was in the dark?
GCNCS know a lot about the Germans, but they are not able to build that up into a solid prediction of what the German plan of attack will be and where and when it will fall. Bletchley specifically have a problem that they need to wait until battle breaks out to really get down to work, because that's when the wireless networks will light up, messages will increase in volume. At this stage of the war, actually, it's still unsure whether that will work, because the received wisdom is that any army that's going to embark on a major operation is not going to use its radios, because it would be far too risky. They would give the game away. And that had caused some to question whether code breaking would actually be a viable way of collecting intelligence. But the code breakers suspect different. They can see these German networks and they're mapping them out. They can see networks which are not in use now that can only be there because they're for some anticipated use in the future.
Setting them up.
Yeah. Mm.
Survey of intelligence from German air and army Enigma traffic. For just over 2 months, it has been possible to read traffic on three discriminants. Green, Army. Blue and red, Air Force. Green has been broken on 10 days, blue on 18, and red on 11. As regards the air, the following features have emerged. The blue traffic in particular reveals an elaborate WT network, which performs elaborate practice operations, but could justify its costly existence only by an activity far greater than it shows as yet. The general WT organisation of the German Air Force is, indeed, what might have been expected. A network radiating as described in Section 2 below, from Air HQ in Berlin to individual aerodromes. And yet stations, or whole groups of stations, manned night and day, will frequently report in their daily activity returns that they have received perhaps two messages in the 24 hours and sent one, or even that they have handled no traffic at all. Naturally, there are other stations and groups far busier, but there remains a surprising amount of inactivity. The giant seems often half asleep. Signed, F.L. Lucas.
The other thing is that a lot of the traffic being sent on the networks is practice traffic or spoof. The Germans are clearly gearing up for a period where their wireless networks are going to be very busy indeed. This just hasn't happened yet. When it does happen is in Norway. When the Battle of Norway breaks out, the yellow key, which the Germans are using there, the volume of traffic is beyond what GCNCS had actually predicted. It surprised them, it surprised the codebreakers in Hut 6 and the intelligence officers in Hut 3, and gave them a lot of work to do. Once the Battle of France breaks out, it will be like this all over again. So Bletchley Park's real work has yet to begin.
This is London. I spent today in the House of Commons. The debate was opened by Herbert Morrison, one of the ablest members of the Labour Party. He doubted that the government was taking the war seriously. Mr. Morrison said that the Labour Party had decided to divide the House. In other words, call for a vote. Mr. Chamberlain, white with anger, intervened in the debate and accepted the challenge. In fact, he welcomed it. He fairly spat the words. He said that he had friends in the House, and he appealed to them to support him. When he had finished, Mr. David Lloyd George rose and placed his notes upon the dispatch box, and members surged into the room through both doors, as though the little, square, gray-shouldered, white-haired Welshman were a magnet to draw them back to their seats. He swept the House with his arm and said, "If there is a man here who is satisfied with our production of planes, of guns, of tanks, or the training of troops, let him stand on his feet." No one stood.
I sought an audience of the King this evening and tendered to him my resignation, which His Majesty has been pleased to accept. His Majesty has now entrusted to my friend and colleague, Mr. Winston Churchill, the task of forming a new administration on a national basis. And in this task, I have no doubt he will be successful.
There is political fallout from the Norway campaign back in Britain, isn't there?
Yeah, so this is a really important moment for Britain, for its leadership, because after British and French troops have to withdraw from Norway, the government comes in for a great deal of criticism about that. And there is a debate on the conduct of the war in Parliament from the 7th to 9th of May, known as the Norway debate. And the government is pilloried at every turn, and this culminates in what is essentially a vote of confidence in the government, which Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, wins narrowly, but he realises he can no longer command support of the House. And so he resigns, and Winston Churchill and Lord Halifax are the candidates to replace him. Churchill's had quite a good war so far, actually, because he's been First Lord of the Admiralty since war broke out. And Britain has had successes at sea, like the Battle of the River Plate. So he's relatively well regarded, but also he's always been a bit of a political outsider. And therefore it's questionable whether he will be able to form a stable government. Halifax is in some ways a safer pair of hands. But actually, he stands aside because he says, as a lord, he won't be able to command the support he'll need. So Churchill is the one who is summoned by the King to become the new Prime Minister and sets about forming his war cabinet, which is a sort of coalition of politicians on all sides of the House. He takes over as Prime Minister on the 10th of May.
I would say to the House, as I said to those who joined the government, I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat. We have before us an ordeal of the most grievous kind. We have before us many, many long months of struggle and of suffering. You ask, what is our policy? I will say, it is to wage war by sea, land, and air, with all our might, with all the strength that God can give us, to wage war against a monstrous tyranny never surpassed in the dark and lamentable catalogue of human crime. That is our policy. You ask, what is our aim? I can answer in one word, victory. Victory at all costs. Victory in spite of all terror. Victory however long and hard the road may be. For without victory there is no survival.
The German army invaded Holland and Belgium early this morning by land and by landings from parachutes. The armies of the Low Countries are resisting. An appeal for help has been made to the Allied governments, and Brussels says that troops are moving to their support.
Das Ziel ist Ypern. Bombardement auf diese schon im Weltkriege so schwer umkämpfte Stadt. Wenn die Engländer und Franzosen jedoch glaubten, hier auch diesmal wieder den deutschen Vormarsch aufhalten zu können, so wurden sie schnell eines Besseren belehrt.
Parachute troops were dropped at more than 25 places in the Netherlands today. And Brussels reported that German planes were flying over almost without interruption, distributing parachutists over Belgium. On land, the Germans have crossed the IJssel River near Arnhem and claimed the capture of that town, though the Dutch dispute this. The principal success claimed by the Germans today was the capture of a strategically important Belgian fort near Liège, which they say was taken by some new tactics, which prove that modern fortifications can be captured by modern methods.
Unsere brave Infanterie geht zum Angriff über. Die erste Linie setzt sich unter dem Schutz des schweren deutschen Artilleriefeuers in Marsch. Die deutsche Panzerdivision ist von Ypern aus vorgestoßen. Feindliche Tanks sind bei Poperinge gemeldet. Sie sollen die Vereinigung zweier deutscher Armeen im Süden von Dünkirchen verhindern.
So this brings us to the 10th of May 1940 and the attack actually happens.
Yes, so the Germans have decided that now is the moment that they have built up enough and they are going to take the initiative and try and knock France out of the war. But of course the battle starts in the Low Countries. Luxembourg is attacked and quickly occupied with little resistance. The Dutch and Belgian armies, of course, resist for longer, but they quickly begin to lose ground facing the German forces they do. And this is a bit of a nasty surprise to the French and the British because they're expecting at least a few weeks' resistance in the Netherlands and Belgium, but that doesn't happen. Within a few days, a lot of the Netherlands is occupied. The Germans are attacking on land, but they also launch some quite innovative airborne operations with gliders, parachutists, and also they actually try and capture airfields and fly troops straight in on transport aircraft. And obviously there was a huge amount of German air activity. And this is decisive in Holland, even though it also leads to very heavy casualties among the Germans, their aircraft and among the landing forces. The Germans break Dutch resistance by launching a pretty much unprovoked attack on a civilian centre. They bomb Rotterdam very heavily. At this stage of the war, strategic bombing of civilian targets is not a thing. So this is largely unprecedented and it's a complete shock to the Dutch, to everyone else. They cause very heavy damage to the city and the Allies consider it a war crime. And as a result, it's the first occasion that the Royal Air Force actually bombs German cities in retaliation. The Dutch surrender on the 15th of May, basically in order to avoid any more cities being bombed into the ground like Rotterdam. So in this case, strategic bombing of a civilian target is decisive. Queen Wilhelmina and the Dutch government escape to Britain, former government in exile. They keep fighting.
Hitler added another to his bag of small nations today, the fifth in 14 months, when the Dutch army laid down its arms everywhere except in the extreme southwestern part of the country. And even there, the Germans have almost reached the sea. While the armored column that had struck clear across the country yesterday was coming up against Rotterdam, which was being blasted by heavy air attacks. So General Winckelmann, the Dutch commander-in-chief, broadcast an order for general surrender. In Belgium, Germans who had turned the flank along the Dutch frontier struck down to the east of Turnhout and fought a heavy battle with British, French, and Belgian mechanized forces east of Louvain.
and fighting is going on between the Heta and Dyle rivers. Still another German flanking force struck straight southward behind the Belgian frontier defense positions, which apparently are still held, and joined the German forces that had pushed up through Luxembourg and southeastern Belgium. In France, as in Belgium, the Germans are apparently trying to outflank the strongest defenses.
Belgium doesn't surrender so quickly because the French army is there. They've moved into central Belgium. There are quite major tank battles as the French try and take up their position on the Dyle line as planned. But as I say, the Germans move quicker than expected, so those battles become scrappy and the French are not able to put a solid defensive line in place. Meanwhile, the real German force is moving through the Ardennes towards the French border against relatively light resistance. The main problem for these panzer forces is actually traffic. They have among them 41,000 vehicles. They have four roads on which to advance, and this actually leads to a 160-mile traffic jam going all the way from the Meuse River all the way back through the Ardennes all the way to the Rhine. This is actually a golden opportunity for the Allies. If they had spotted this concentration of vehicles and been able to bomb them...
Surely they must have been spotted.
So they were spotted, but they were not bombed, or at least not to the extent they needed to be. The French High Command seemed to be unable to take proper account of that intelligence, basically. And a problem here actually is that they overestimate somewhat the amount of armour the Germans have. So they see these traffic jams and they still think it's possible the Germans are aiming their main thrust into central Belgium. But basically, the opportunity is missed to bomb these columns while they're vulnerable.
Here, standing on the Franco-Belgian frontier, we're watching long columns of British troops and transports and supplies and guns coming through from France into Belgium. Just on this frontier, there's a little village which is presumably half French and half Belgian, since it stretches on both sides. And almost the entire village has turned out and seems to be standing in the street all day long watching these transports coming up. The welcome given by the Belgian people is really tremendous.
This roughly was the position when the British squadron was ordered to the attack. A French force was falling back and they were engaged in a race with an advanced German motorized column which was rushing round to try and cut them off. It seemed possible that the Germans might manage it, and so the order went out, hold up that German column. The Germans have been bombing again today, mainly roads and aerodromes and refugees. And in one village, they hit a hospital, killing and injuring a number of people. Their latest trick, one which goes on top of bombing and shooting the ever-increasing stream of refugees, is to machine gun the cattle in the French fields, and lots of these have been seen lying about dead.
Within 3 or 4 days of the operation starting, the Germans are through the Ardennes and actually over the Meuse into France. They do this by achieving a very strong concentration of air power by the crossings. The French expect the Germans to stop at the river to bring up artillery to launch what a sort of set-piece attack over the river. Instead, the Germans just bomb the hell out of the defenders. They launch the air attacks all day on the 14th of May, which, as well as doing damage, just completely demoralise the defenders. And they're able to roll straight across the river without any real build-up. So they do it a lot quicker than anyone expects. So within 4 days of the war starting, they are through the Ardennes and over the Meuse, and they have open country in front of them.
Is that a lot quicker than the Germans themselves expected?
Yeah, this is going very well compared to what the Germans expected. At this point, actually, the German High Command want their spearheads to stop. They've created their bridgehead. That's enough. Anything more would be too risky. And they know the French are now getting their act together and they're going to respond and there are going to be counterattacks.
Why on earth would they want them to slow down?
These are armoured forces. They have limited amounts of infantry. They're very vulnerable. They're not very capable of holding ground under heavy attack for long periods. So the High Command want the infantry to catch up to the tanks and reinforce the position. And here is where things start getting out of the control of the German High Command. One of the generals in charge of one of the Panzer Corps, which has just crossed the Meuse, is Heinz Guderian. And he's a proponent of modern armoured tactics. He'd actually made a contribution to the Manstein plan because he'd talked to Manstein and given his opinion on the plan back before it was adopted. And so he's a true believer in what tanks can do. And he'd actually, in the late 30s, written a book called Achtung Panzer, all about his ideas. Once over the Meuse, he resists suggestions to stop. And eventually he refuses the orders to stop. He intentionally misinterprets his orders. And at one point he threatens to resign. And at one point he actually is removed and then reinstated and allowed to continue. But there are various ruses by Guderian and by other German generals to keep things moving. Guderian also adds a part of the Manstein plan which had been stripped out. because Manstein had anticipated a French counterattack on the Meuse bridgehead, and he'd arranged a spoiling attack to be launched actually not going west towards the coast, but going south, where the French armour would be forming up. And he thinks if the Germans attack first, they will take the momentum out of that attack before it even begins. And this is what Guderian does. So he sends part of his force south to a place called Ston, which controls a plateau which is high up and strategically important territory to hold. And the Germans capture the place, the French counterattack and retake it. This actually goes back and forth 17 times, this quite small village swapping hands before the Germans finally secure it. And even though the French have strong forces in the area and they have some of their very heavy tanks, their Char-1Bs, which are heavier and tougher than any tank the Germans can field and are actually a really tough proposition for them to take out, they're not capable in the end of putting these forces into a strong armoured spearhead that can push through the German lines and recapture the bridgehead. Instead, they spread these tanks out in penny packets. They try and defend at the same time as they attack. When they spread their tanks out, they can't bring them back in again to launch an attack later on. There are real problems with the way the French are employing their armour, which dissipates its effectiveness. And that's why the Germans are able to just about hold on. Meanwhile, the rest of the German armour is driving for the coast, down the Somme Valley as fast as they possibly can, overrunning French divisions on the way. And this is what's become known as Blitzkrieg.
On the 12th day of the offensive, German armoured columns struck down the valley of the Somme, captured Amiens, thus cutting rail connections between Paris and the northern channel ports, and pushed on to the sea at Abbeville. The German high command, however, has not claimed that more than armored divisions have got this far, though unofficial German sources say that considerable numbers of infantry are following them. Advanced motor forces are striking northward up the coast, but are meeting not only land opposition, but the fire of warships in the channel. Another German column, protecting the flank of the one moving down the Somme Valley, took Arras 25 miles to the north. By these successes, the Allied armies have been cut in two. By the thrust to Abbeville, some 700,000 British, French, and Belgian troops are more or less encircled by the Germans with their backs to the channel from Boulogne to Ostend.
Blitzkrieg is an idea that's been mythologized, and the Germans later in the war, and then historians who basically believe their propaganda, claimed that this was all planned, and that the Germans had come up with a new way of warfare called Blitzkrieg, which was sort of a strategic economic plan, first of all, that you would launch these lightning attacks on enemy countries and take them out quickly, and you would build up your economy in such a way that it can support short attacks, but not so much for the long term. And this also translates into tactics on the battlefield itself, where you combine armour and air power to break through the enemy lines and break through to their rear areas and defeat them that way. But this is nothing like as concerted a doctrine, as some people have said. So that's the first part of the myth. The second part of the myth is that the entire German army is behind this idea. And that's not true either, because a lot of German generals are very, very sceptical of whether this will work. And throughout the Battle of France are saying this is going to be disastrous because they're going to cut off our armoured spearheads and we're going to lose this battle. So the fact that it all goes well is as much to do with luck than judgment, really. It's certainly not planned. And I suppose the third part of the myth is that it's anything new. Actually, the Germans have had very long entrenched ideas of fighting a decisive battle, winning wars quickly by eliminating the enemy army rather than going for sort of strategic objectives, industrial objectives, whatever, and in concentrating their troops into a key point, what they call a Schwerpunkt, and winning victory that way. This is nothing new. It goes back, as I said, all the way to the Prussians in the 18th century. The idea with the Schwerpunkt is if you identify the enemy's sort of center of gravity and you attack it with your strongest forces and destroy the enemy there, then their entire army and their entire plan of battle will fall apart. So that is what is done in France in 1940. It's really nothing new. It goes back to long-standing ideas of how the Germans fight wars. So the success which they achieve when they get across the Meuse and they drive to the sea is not a concerted plan. It's accidental in many ways. It's luck. It could have all gone very, very badly wrong. And it's as much a surprise to the German high command as it is to the Allies. That's the amazing thing.
I was going to say, and some of it relies on Guderian defying orders as well. So
I have a quote from Halder, who's trying to control the battle and failing. And in his diary wrote, "The Führer is terribly nervous, frightened by his own success. He's afraid to take any chance and so would pull the reins on us. He keeps worrying about the south flank, the flank of this huge breakthrough which the Germans are creating. He rages and screams that we are on the way to ruin the whole campaign." So Hitler is panicking at this stage And this is why these repeated orders are coming from the German High Command to Guderian and the other panzer generals to stop, to halt, let the infantry catch up and stop sticking their necks out so much, otherwise it might get cut off. The Germans also benefit from a very high level of training among their officers and their non-commissioned officers, and especially given them an idea that they need to exercise their initiative, not just follow orders blindly. And they have a concept called Auftragstaktik, which is that a commander will give an objective to their subordinate, but it's up to the subordinate how they actually achieve that objective with the forces at their disposal. It's meant to avoid micromanagement. And this means, unlike the French and the British, there are people on the ground who are willing to take opportunities when they see them in the Germans, and that's very important as well, to keep the advance rolling.
So is this why Guderian can get away with it?
Ultimately, Guderian gets away with it because it works. If it had all gone badly wrong and all his tanks had been cut off and destroyed, he might have been captured. And if he wasn't captured, it would have been the end of his military career. But Hitler rewards success and it goes well in the end. One of the ruses Guderian uses is that he's permitted to send out a reconnaissance. And instead of sending out, you know, a few troops, he sends out a reconnaissance in force and just sends his entire force, basically. So he does a very heavy reconnaissance in force, which ends up capturing ground. And then by the time his commanders hear about them pushing forwards, it's been done. So obviously they're not going to give up ground that they've captured. So they move forward and they secure it. And through ruses like that, through sort of creatively misinterpreting the orders and really making the most of the orders he does get, that's how the advance is done.
I'm Doris Moss. I worked at Bletchley Park and Hut 4 and Hut 6.
Doris, I've been told that you've got a fascinating story that starts before you even get to Bletchley Park.
Oh, yes, I did. My father married a Belgian girl, lady. He worked in France, so we lived in France till I was 7. And then I went to Belgium because my father went to England in the army during the war. And we had to leave Belgium because of the bombing. And the Germans might have put us in a concentration camp, my sister and I, you see. So that we took a train all the way down to the south of France. And on the way down, in the train, we were bombed by the Germans. That was my mother, my sister and I.
So this was 1940?
1940. And a dog.
What was the dog's name?
Rita. She was a Cocker Spaniel. We left her in the south of France, actually. Oh. And so we took a train and we were bombed while we were in the train. But they didn't get the station. They came later on in the evening and got the station. Mm. And then they took us out of the train and made us walk to the next station. The Germans came over with their aeroplanes, so we all lay down flat on the ground. And when they'd gone, we left, went up to the next stop, and we went on another train through Spain up to Lisbon, and that's where we stayed. And when we got to Lisbon, a ship left with some of the refugees, but we were not on the list because we came too late. And that was sunk with all hands on deck.
Oh, good Lord.
So they decided, the British government decided to have a big ship. We went in Lisbon for 4 months, and then we went to Gibraltar, and there we waited for a big ship to take us back to England, and it was a Polish ship. We were told to put our passports and our names and stand by the lifeboats because we were going through a minefield. So, of course, that's another escape. And we got to England after 6 days in a Polish ship.
When you got to England, did you just want to do your bit to fight against
the
Germans?
Well, we thought we'd have to do something, didn't we? So we thought the best thing was to try to, and we went to Bletchley Park.
Because I suppose, really, more than most of our veterans at Bletchley Park, you'd actually witnessed the Nazis firsthand, hadn't you?
I did, yes.
And that must have given you a real momentum to want to do something.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Thanks to the paid and volunteer staff, visitors and veterans who took part in this podcast. To find out more, go to bletchleypark.org.uk. You can follow Bletchley Park on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine and supported by Audioboom. If you like this podcast, please leave us a review on iTunes.
Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.